Good morning. I call the House Education Finance Committee to order. And with that, our first order of business is the minutes. Representative, Jordan, have you had a chance to look at the minutes yet? Or Representative Purcell, either one.
Also, Mrs.
Madam Chair, I have now reviewed the minutes. And I would move their approval.
Thank you. Representative Jordan moves the approval of the minutes for March 27th. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The minutes of March 27th are adopted. With that, our next order of business is to welcome our new member, Representative Brian Lawrence, who's joining us today. And we thought we'd let you give a few minutes to introduce yourself, what school districts you represent, and your area. And then we'll go around and briefly do the same for you so you can get to know us.
Okay, appreciate that. My name is Brian Lawrence. I'm from the Princeton area, House District 27B, and was sworn in yesterday and thrilled and honored to be a part of the House and be a representative at this point in time. And grateful to be appointed to this committee as well. I know that it's late in the game, but looking forward to catching up and learning about the process that we have here. And so looking forward to working with you. I live in the just south of Princeton, Baldwin Township, with my wife of 28 years and where we raised our four children, two of which are married at this point in time. The third is going to be married at the end of the month, end of May, not this month, end of May, and one in high school as of yet. And so he's a junior in high school. I've been part of a family farming business. We raise registered Hereford cattle as well as Kentucky bluegrass sod. My mother, brother, and I still own and operate those businesses together today. And so other than that, the school districts, I've got Princeton School, Zimmerman Schools, as well as St. Francis at this point in time that I get to be a part of. So, and my children actually wound up, because of where we live, they get to be a part of the Princeton School District at this point in time. So grateful and excited to be able to be a part of our process. So thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we'll move around the table too. I'm Representative Cheryl Joachim. I live in Hopkins, represent Hopkins, parts of St. Louis Park and parts of Edina, and represent all those three school districts. And then I'll move next to our committee administrator.
Polly Sikbenik, committee administrator, Education Finance.
And then Representative Clardy, and then we'll just move around.
I'm Representative Clardy. I represent Invergrove Heights, Sunfish Lake, Lilydale, Mendota Heights, and South St. Paul or West St. Paul. And the two school districts I represent are Invergrove Heights and Mendota Heights.
I'm Representative Vernick. So thanks for coming. I'm now not the new guy. Woohoo! I represent Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan District. That's 196, and West St. Paul District 197. I represent 52B, Eagan, Mendota Heights, and Mendota.
Hi, I'm Representative Lucy Ream. I represent Chanhassen and Chaska, so I represent the Eastern Carver County School District as well as Minnetonka School District. We also have the Intermediate District 288 in my area and a number of charter schools, including the World Learner Charter School. So nice to meet you.
Hi, I'm Lori Pryor. I represent the southern part of Minnetonka and the northern part of Eden Prairie, and the school districts are Hopkins, Minnetonka, and Eden Prairie. And I appreciate what Representative Brooms just said. I can't name all the charter schools that are in the district, but I know that I've got a couple of them. One of them, I just visited this year, is Lions Gates is one of them, and I think I've got another one, too, that's within the district. We're no longer meeting, but I'm the chair of the education policy. Also related, and on a week from tomorrow, our policy bill will be on the floor. So that'll be something that you can catch up on and one of the votes that you can take in education. So welcome.
Thank you. Hi there. I'm Representative Christy Purcell. I represent 58A, which is southern Minnesota, parts of Rice, Scott, and Dakota County. My school districts are Northfield Public Schools, New Prague Area School District, and the Tri-City United. Nice to meet you. Welcome.
Good morning. It's nice to meet you, Representative Lawrence. My name is Representative Maria Isabel Vega. I represent this district that we're sitting in right here, 65B of St. Paul, and half of West St. Paul with Representative Clardy. I represent the St. Paul, Public School District and West St. Paul, which shares with Mendota Heights, and a number of charter schools, private schools. I come from a background of directing after-school programming throughout the MPS and St. Paul Public School sectors, and it's great to have you on board here. We're doing some amazing, historic things in the state of Minnesota to benefit all of our beautiful children and educators. Gracias.
Hi, I'm Representative Josiah Hill. I represent 33B, which is the East Metro along the St. Croix River. The districts in 33B are Stillwater, Forest Lake, and several charters and a few private schools as well. Nice to meet you.
Hi, good morning. I am Representative Emma Greenman, and I represent South Minneapolis in the House and hold up the Minneapolis delegation's Minneapolis Public Schools corner of this table. And I was just noticing that we have the two members who come in who came in special session, so it's fun to have both of you here. So welcome.
Samantha Sensimura, I represent South Minneapolis and Minneapolis Public Schools.
Hi, I'm Sydney Jordan. I represent 60A, where I have the privilege of representing the people of Northeast Minneapolis and Southeast Como, and I proudly represent Minneapolis Public Schools.
I'm Maris Beltrandi-Redquist, DFL Caucus Research.
I'm Jody Withers, House Republican Research. I represent no one.
Ron Krisha, I represent 10A, which is just west of you. I have the Mille Lacs, Kennebec, parts of Crow Wing, Morrison, and Aiken counties. Welcome.
I'm Peggy Bennett. I live in Albert Lee. I represent 23A, which is, boy, almost to Blue Earth, and then over just a little past Albert Lee and up in large area. But lots of school districts. I won't list them all. A few private schools as well. I've been an elementary school teacher. I'm retired now for 33 years. Love kids. Love education. Good to have you here. And that giant thumping is not the heartbeat of this building. It's actually the construction, just so you know, we get to hear that down here. So,
Ben Bakeberg, I represent 54B. It's the school districts of Prior Lake, Shakopee, and Jordan, and then a number of private schools as well. So looking forward to working with you.
Thank you. Patty Anderson, 33A, which is Northwest Washington County. I represent Forest Lake, White Bear Lake, Matamidi, and a tiny bit of Stillwater School District.
Hello, welcome. Hi, I'm Representative Krista Knudsen, 5A. Park Rapids is our biggest city, so that's where we're at. I have 16 different school districts in my House district, so I'm not going to list them all, but some of the bigger ones are like Park Rapids, Detroit Lakes, a little bit of Detroit Lakes, Brainerd. Yeah, welcome to the committee.
Welcome, Brian. I am Pam Altendorf from the Red Wing area. Is my district Cannon Falls, Goodhue, Wabasha, Lake City.
Hi, I'm Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. I serve on this committee as well as the Children and Families Committee. Welcome.
Good morning. Christina Pera from House Research.
Tim Strom from House Research.
I'm Shamada Braha. I am the committee legislative assistant.
Get the elevator for me this morning.
Thank you all for introducing yourself to a newest member. And with that, I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Clardy so I can present the governor's supplemental education budget proposal.
Good morning. The next item on the agenda is House File 5237. Chair Joachim, would you like to move House File 5237 before the committee with the intention to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the Ed Finance Bill?
Thank you, Vice Chair Clardy. Yes, I would.
You may present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Clardy. I would like, sorry about that. Thank you, Chair Clardy. As you said, this is the Governor's Education Finance Supplemental Finance Bill. That is traditional for the chair of the committee to carry the governor and lieutenant governor's proposal in our committee for the discussion. That's what we're doing here today. There are a few individual proposals in this bill that we've had before our committee, and there are pieces in this bill that we'll be considering for inclusion in the final education finance committee bill. So with that, I'll have a variety of testifiers from MDE to walk through the bill, and I have Sylvia Beckel here from House Fiscal Analyst to briefly walk through the spreadsheet after that, and then we'll also take testimony from folks who signed up and then move on to member discussion on the bill. With that, I will turn it over to Commissioner Willie Jett from the Department of Education.
Wonderful. Commissioner Jett.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Willie Jett, and I serve as the Commissioner of Education. I'd just like to thank you, Chair, for hearing the Governor's supplemental education budget and for the opportunity to share some remarks. As you have heard from my team and me previously, we have been intensively focused on implementation of the 2023 education budget. And in our schools and in our visits around the state, we continue to see and hear about the success and growth from the historic education funding and changes from last year's session. A quick little tidbit for you. I was visiting an elementary school in Greater Minnesota just a couple months ago. I went into a second grade classroom and met a teacher who asked if she could share something with me while her students were working in small groups. With a mixture of gratitude and vulnerability, she shared her journey of teaching and her recent experience with language training for reading and spelling, the letters program. She confessed that in the past, despite her best efforts, there were students she felt she couldn't reach, children who had struggles with reading, and they left her feeling helpless and frustrated. At that moment, there were some tears that welled up in her eyes, and she spoke about the transformation that had taken place since implementing the letters program. She described how the structured and systematic approach had equipped her with the tools and confidence to help every child in her classroom become proficient readers. She shared her appreciation for the direction provided by the state and MDE, admitting that while she was reluctant to take on new professional development at this stage in her career, but she also said that without the expectation and support MDE provided, it's likely little would have changed. In that moment, I witnessed the profound impact that effective training and support can have on dedicated educators. Her tears were not just tears of sadness for the past, but tears of joy for the future, a future where every child has the opportunity to unlock the magic of reading and soar to new heights. As I left that classroom that day, her words lingered in my mind, and it was a powerful reminder of resilience and dedication of teachers everywhere across the state. And I just couldn't help but feel a sense of renewed inspiration. And for that, I just want to say thank you. In the supplemental education budget, the governor focused on refining those newly enacted programs, technical but necessary statutory changes, and no-cost ways the state can continue to improve. Many of these supplemental budget proposals reflect changes that need to be made this session. Last year, the legislature, in addition to making 4,000 expiring voluntary pre-kindergarten spots permanent, set aside $50 million for additional voluntary pre-kindergarten seats. This year, the supplemental budget includes the necessary changes to allocate 5,200 seats to districts. Voluntary pre-K is a critical program to support our preschoolers across the state, and both families and district alike are asking for more. So we're excited about the growth of this program over the coming years. The bill also includes language changes necessary to fully and better implement other programs, such as more clearly defining English learner expenditures so that districts and charter schools are reporting information to MDE consistently and families have clearer expectations on how revenue is used at the local level. Other changes in the bill will provide more flexibility for grant funds to support the workforce to reach as many educators as possible and streamline implementation of various programs. These are changes that we hope are straightforward and easy to support. I appreciate the committee's time today and look forward to partnering with you as you put together your omnibus budget bill with our shared goals of supporting a safe, healthy, and supportive teaching and learning environment for our students and educators. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Adosh Uni, to walk through the bill.
Thank you, Commissioner Jett. Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. And I'm going to walk through the governor's bill as quickly as I possibly can. But I'd also like to note if there are any questions along with me, I have my colleagues from the government relations team here, and then online we have our director of school finance, Kathy Erickson, ask and answer any technical questions. Article 1, the first section is the clarification on kindergarten average daily membership. This was a proposal that was passed last year, but there's still some cleanup language that needs to be put in. This is in two sections, Section 1 and Section 5 of Article 1. The next section is on area learning center transportation aid. It's a modification to allow for recipients of area learning transportation aid to include cooperative units that provide their own transportation for ALCs. The next section is on the English learner cross subsidy qualifying cost definition. Remember last year the legislature not only put more funding for English learner aid, but also created an English learner cross subsidy aid stream starting in fiscal 27 that relies on second prior year data, so fiscal 25. So we're coming forward with some parameters, a definition of what those qualifying services would be for English learner services. So it adds definition in law regarding the allowable costs and more specificity to provide clarification to districts, and that will be aligned with more guidance that we put out as a department. Section 4 is aligning the law with what the best practice would be for school unemployment aid distribution. We put out a survey this last fall to districts to ascertain what their costs were for unemployment aid for hourly school workers during the summer term to allow districts to be able to get funding when the bills came due for providing that, providing the unemployment reimbursement that comes in the fall. So the aid distribution was made at 90% based on the unvalidated data we got from the survey. And that we would do the remaining 10% next fall when we have final validated data. The current law right now requires that 100% of the aid is paid in the current year. That doesn't allow for this practice, so we would ask that the legislation be changed to allow for 90% in the current year and 10% in the following year. There are a range of proposal or a range of provisions that reflect the allocation of the $50 million that was set aside last year for voluntary pre-kindergarten seats. This Article 1, Section 6 is the first of those. This is across almost all of the articles. This would allow for the 2023 legislation or set aside funding to be to fund the 5,200 seats in fiscal year 25. And that would reach a total of 12,360 seats for the program in total. The next section is around a technical clarification for compensatory revenue. It corrects duplicative and conflicting language related to the allowance for fiscal 26 and later. This is Section 7 and 8. Section 9 is around operating capital levy exemption clarification. This is clarifying that the aid related to purchasing menstrual products and opiate antagonists passed during the last session is not subject to levy equalization under the statute. Section 12 is around one-room schoolhouse funding modification. This changes it. This is the one-room schoolhouse in the Angle Islet school up in the War Road School District. This clarifies that it's a grant. Converts it from a grant to an aid. This would simplify the distribution to the district. Section 13 is allowing districts to execute a one-time transfer on their from a reserved or restricted account under basic skills revenue into another restricted account for basic skills revenue based on the changes that were made for the uses for basic skills revenue last year. There were some uses that are no longer allowed or no longer transferred over to the new definition, but we're in a restricted account, so this just allows for those funds to be used still for basic skills revenue. In Article 2, Section 1 is around clarifications for paraprofessional training aid. This clarifies that all of the recipients of the aid have to provide the training, and this is specifically adding in intermediates and other cooperative units, Purpich Center for Arts Education and the Minnesota State Academies. They already received the aid, but this provides the clarification in statute that they have to provide the training there. We just wanted to make sure that that was tightened up. And then it additionally defines compensation eligible for reimbursement as regularly hourly wages, FICA taxes, and employer-paid pension contributions. The next section is the first of, I think, seven or eight around will grant appropriation availability modifications. This extends the availability of 7 grant programs administered by MDE from June 2024 to June 2025 and makes technical corrections to 3 others. I'm not going to point them out as we go along, but this is just note that there's 7 or 8 of them across the bill. The next one is also around a grantee modification, but this is specific to the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. This aligns the grant timeline with other named grant timelines for other grantees, and this is in line with the Office of Grant Management. This one, in current legislation, requires the department to allocate the funds on a date specific, but this would allow us to distribute the funds based on deliverables and at the same time eliminate the statutory timeline for payment. In Article 3, this is around American Indian Education Carry Forward Adjustment. This revises the period in which the funding can be carried over from 1 year into the next. This extends it from 6 months to 1 year that it can be carried over and be expended by. So if a district has funding left over in year one under American Indian Education Aid that they receive and have approved under a plan they submit to the department, if they haven't expended it completely, they would be able to carry over a portion and then expend it by the end of the next fiscal year for those same purposes. In Article 4, the second section is on alternative teacher compensation revenue for QComp program. This is just making it clear in statute that any funds that are reserved that have been unused in year one, if they're used and reserved for the next year, that they have to be in a restricted fund and only used for their intended purposes. The next few sections are on the Grow Your Own program. This would do several additions to it. First is adding tribal contract schools and eligible grantee. It would allow scholarships to be used at community colleges. And then it would allow existing grantees to revise their current grant agreements to allow for any of these new uses or any new uses that would come to the statute in the future. The next set of sections is around the Special Education Teacher Pipeline Program the grant that was passed last year. This also adds tribal contract schools as an eligible grantee and allows funds to support any participant employed by the recipient. So that would add tier 3 and tier 4 teachers, employees, and it would allow also community members affiliated with the grant recipient to be eligible participants in that program, and then allows existing grantees to revise their contracts to allow for these new changes to grants that they've already executed once the law passes. And I want to be clear that the addition of these of tier 3, tier 4 is still after the tier 1 and tier 2 teachers are prioritized. So it doesn't change anything around the prioritization buckets. It just allows there's funding left over for grantee participants to be able to use these funds for their tier 3, tier 4 teachers. Next section is on the student support personnel aid. If there's some modifications to allow districts and charters to retain the unspent aid in a restricted fund balance, and that's limited to the amount of the prior year's aid allocation. Currently, if there's any unexpended aid, the law is written that require the funds to go back to the general fund. This allows funds to be carried over from year to year, but still be used for those purposes. Section 12 is on the statewide teacher mentoring program. This allows the funds to be used to support mentorship for tier 2 special education teachers in addition to the current participants who are tier 1 teachers. Article 5 is on charter schools. This is a modification of the charter school lease aid review. This allows the commissioner to develop a system of analyzing the financial viability of multiple charter school leases. The next few articles 6, 7, and 8 are sections that have to do with the modifications for amounts that are associated with the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, as I had mentioned in the first article, or they are grants that have extended timelines as mentioned in the first article as well. So I'm not going to cover those in this presentation, but happy to answer any questions should they come up after that. Article 9, I just wanted to point out this voluntary pre-kindergarten section specifically because this is the actual language that adjusts the number of seats, and so it's just important to point this one out. It's not like the other sections that adjust numbers in other aid programs. This one is one of the more operative sections in here. The next section is the Head Start Administrative Support. This allows 2% of the early Head Start and Head Start appropriation be used for state-level program and funding distribution for support beginning in 2025. And I believe the section four, I apologize, in this first bullet point about voluntary pre-kindergarten, section one is around the seat adjustment. Section four is the repealer that repeals the session law from last year that allocated the initial $50 million set aside. And then that resulting repeal also is associated with all the other sections that distributes the funding across the other aid streams. And Article 10 is the state agencies. This is around $2.8 million appropriation to Pelsby for information technology costs. And then Article 11 is just the standard forecast article, and that completes the review of the governor's 2024 supplemental education bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Director Uni. We are now going to move on to Ms. Solvay. Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Solvay Beckel, House Fiscal. So you received three spreadsheets in your packet. The one that I am going to go through is on the letter-sized page. It's the change-only spreadsheet, so it's just going to highlight the changes that this bill is making over the base budget. So the title is House K through 12 Education Finance, Governor's 2024 Recommendations, Change Only. Now, the voluntary pre-kindergarten measures that Mr. Uni just mentioned take up the bulk of this spreadsheet. So the voluntary pre-kindergarten changes are in Article 9, but then they are also spread throughout the bill because they are on a pupil formula. So the changes for VPK impact not only general education, but you can see on line 8 here as well, achievement and integration aid 9, charter school building lease aid 10, alternative teacher comp aid, and you can see the other items in the formula funding that the voluntary pre-kindergarten changes impact. So the lines from 4 to, 14 are showing the changes of the increase in 5,200 voluntary pre-kindergarten seats in fiscal year 25 only. Line 15 shows the reduction from the voluntary pre-kindergarten reserve of $50 million that was established last year. And now that was just set aside to create more seats, but they weren't sure at the time how much those seats would cost. So the $50 million was set aside, and because the 5,200 seats only cost roughly $38 million, you can see $12 million is left over from that amount. Of course, when it comes to anything on the formula or in education, Representative Lawrence, you'll learn this soon, everything is 90-10 if it's a program. Most things are 90-10 if it's a program, not all things. So you can see then in column D, that is the 10% cleanup payment for those voluntary pre-kindergarten impacts. So $4.128 million is being spent in the second biennium for the voluntary pre-kindergarten changes. So you could say that the net impact of the voluntary pre-kindergarten changes is negative $8 million because there was $50 million set aside. So there's $8 million in savings. I should point out that lines 6 and 7 show the levy offsets. So because the voluntary pre-kindergarten seats are linked to levy impacts, here the governor's language adjusts both the local optional revenue and the operating capital in Article 1, Section 6 and Article 1, Section 10, so that there would be no levy impact and no increases or decreases in property taxes. And so that is the total cost of the voluntary pre-kindergarten provision, including the levy buy-down impacts. Moving down to line 18, the Pelsby appropriation is just for the educators' online licensing system, so basically some IT costs that Pelsby has identified, and that is $2.767 million in fiscal year 25 only. So the total general fund changes in fiscal year 25, fiscal years 24 and 25 is negative 9.237, so a savings of negative 9.237. And then the impact in fiscal years 26 and 27 is 4.128 million, so in spending. There are changes to the special revenue fund as well. Mr. Uni mentioned the change in Article 1, Section 4 of the unemployment aid account. So this is just shifting that account to a 90% and 10% program because it was previously established as a 100% entitlement in the current year. So this is just shifting it like many other education programs are shifted. The back of the sheet just provides some more detail on the levy breakdown, what each of those levies, how they are impacted by the voluntary pre-kindergarten seats. And this is in entitlement versus appropriation. The front page of the spreadsheet shows appropriation. This side of the sheet shows entitlement. And Madam Chair, that is the spreadsheet.
Thank you. We are now going to move on to one. We had one member from the public that signed up to testify on Health Bill 5237. And Caitlin Schneider, could you please come forward?
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Caitlin Schneider, representing Education Minnesota and our 84,000 educators today. I'd like to start with one piece of this budget that we're very excited about, and it's a real sleeper on the hanger, but really fantastic when you try it on. And that is on page 28, the appropriation for Pelsby. This is money to allow all of our teacher members to do their online licenses online versus the current paper process. And I know that none of your constituents are writing in saying, please fund Pelsby. But they are writing in about things that Pelsby does, like the STAR report on retention, how well we're keeping or not retaining our teachers of color, our special education teachers. So it's critically important to so many things that we work on at the Capitol to maintain their budget and make sure that they're easily accessible. The second item I'd like to talk about is in relation to the special education teacher pipeline. I'm referring to language at 17.18. We would prefer to maintain listing paraprofessionals here. And why? The reason why is because we think that they should also be elevated in the priority, both from MDE awarding the grants and the grantees themselves. So right now we are prioritizing tier one teachers and tier two teachers. We feel paraprofessionals are also worthy of that elevation as well. We're a little confused by the inclusion of community members. An employee has a very clear relationship with an employer. There's a connection there. There's a relationship. There's probably a contract outlining that relationship. I'm curious what community member means in this instance. Third, I would like to talk about language on page 18.21. This establishes a reserve account for the student support personnel aid that was appropriated by the legislature last year. It is my understanding that this language was brought forward without consulting any school counselors, school psychologists, school nurses, school social workers. And I want to say that I understand the difficult position the agency is when it comes to the governor's budget. It is the governor's budget. He has the right to put it on the table, and that can limit some of these conversations in the forefront. But there's sort of a troubling trend happening where people, for all good intentions, are making changes to student support personnel aid without those personnel at the table. They have a different proposal. It's House File 4817, a Representative Berg bill, that would allow a reserve account with limits. Their approach is a dollar size limit. I worked with Mr. Strom, and having a carry forward for a year or 2 years would require a lot of paperwork that no one here wants to do. So their approach was a dollar limit on that reserve account. This money is to be spent on our kids. It's not to be carried forward year after year after year. So we would appreciate that consideration for the committee. And lastly, as the committee has a target that is above this bill, as you're building your budget, I would strongly urge consideration for READ Act stipends for our teachers undergoing training and supports for our student teachers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Do we have any questions, committee members? Representative Sensenmura.
thank you. So my question is about the voluntary pre-K seats. So I'm wondering if someone can explain kind of how are those seats being allocated throughout the state, and when will we know kind of what the number breakdown is by district for those seats?
Chair Yukim.
Thank you, Chair Clardy. And with that, I believe they're being allocated through the regular process, and I see Representative Ferris Vega from Early Childhood shaking her head yes, but I'll also toss it to nonpartisan staff. Oh, MDE, actually.
Thank you. As you approach the stand, please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, members, Shayna Morris, Assistant Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. Representative Sensormira, they would be allocated just like any other additional seats are allocated. While this is an increase, this is something the department actually goes through, often on a biennial basis, because the 4,000 seats haven't been made permanent in the past. So they'll get allocated as normal. Districts will have an opportunity to apply, and they'll be, again, allocated just like they are under statute.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, sir. And I think I'm just not super familiar. Can you explain to me how they are currently allocated?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Sensormira, it's a little bit nuanced, but generally speaking, there's regions in the state, and the overall allocation happens based upon kindergarten enrollment. So looking at the kindergarten enrollment of each region gets seats, and then within that region, they're allocated based upon some different criteria on the sites.
Thank you, Ms. That applied. Thanks, Ms. Morris. Representative Sensormira, follow up.
So, and maybe we can continue the conversation if it's just me. So when do districts kind of know how many seats they have?
Madam Chair, Representative Sensormira.
Ms. Morris.
Typically, there's an application process that's established in statute, where I want to say it's like January 31st, and then there's a couple of months until they would know. So right now, what will end up happening is if this passes, those allocation changes will be made sort of, I don't want to say on a retroactive basis, because of course the seats are prospective, but it would be sort of a review and renewal of the application process that's already occurred and the seats that have been applied for.
Thank you, Ms. Morris.
And maybe it's worth also pointing out that the demand for voluntary pre-kindergarten seats by our districts has greatly exceeded what's been available from the state. So there's not a concern that these seats haven't been applied for or where do they need to go. The districts have said, here's our capacity, here's what we want, and that's even knowing a lower limit. And so there's also, again, a statute pretty clearly lays out how they get distributed between these regions, within the regions, and the districts have the capacity. So I don't think there's a question in our mind about how this would roll out. It's just more of a, when will districts get the notification? And that probably would take like a month after something like this passes to get the official notification.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. Representative Sensormira, any follow-up? Okay. Lead Krisha.
And I can go to the end if you don't have any other ones.
Any other questions? Representative Vernick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, too, around what a community member affiliated with the grant recipient is. I don't know, Rep. Joachim, if you can answer that or not, and why we're prioritizing that over paraprofessionals or unlicensed staff who are ready.
Thank you.
Mr. Uni.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Vernick. Since it is the governor's proposal, I will pass it over to Mr. Uni.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Vernick, again, for the record, Adosha Uni, Director of Government Relations, the Minnesota Department of Education. To the second part of the question, it's our intent with the language that this isn't prioritizing any community member over paraprofessionals. It's employees and community members, and including Tier 3 and Tier 4 teachers. So I want to make clear that there's no prioritization of community member over affiliated with or associated with the district or charter over any paraprofessional or any other unlicensed staff. I think the intention with community member is a volunteer, so a non-employee related individual who may be working in the schools with our students. So it's a volunteer who may be working in capacity of providing assistance in classes and may not have a particular contract. So that's what we were trying to accomplish there.
Great. Thanks for the clarification. Sorry.
Representative Vernick, follow-up?
Yeah. Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Any further questions? Lead Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, just to help set the table here, I am going to ask Commissioner Jett to come back up, and then I also will have a question for Ms. Schneider from Ed Minnesota after that. So just let everyone know.
Thank you. Welcome back. Could you please identify yourself again for the record?
Willie Jett, Commissioner of Education.
Lead Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, first of all, thank you. I've always enjoyed our open and honest conversations, and you've been very receptive in reaching out. Just a couple questions on the bill. So first of all, I notice in here there really isn't a focus on some of the graduation, the stagnant graduation rates, and some of the chronic absenteeism. And I'm just looking for, and I'm not asking you to defend or deny, you know, just tell me why there's not as much focus on there. Where do you think the governor's stance on that? How would you respond to that?
Commissioner Jett.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, in terms of the emphasis on graduation rates and absenteeism, that is something that I've spoke at length across the state and had conversation with superintendents and district representatives and the governor's office about absenteeism, and it's also a big thing at the national level. Your question, I believe, was where is that or why is there not, your perception is that there's not as much emphasis on that in the bill. And I think we need to get our hands completely wrapped around it. And so what we're doing is speaking to different districts and superintendents and having that as a national conversation. I actually have a meeting next week with a local district or a consortium of superintendents, because there's no right or wrong answer in terms of how to do that, but we want to make sure that we're doing it correctly and in sync and in collaboration, because it's not just an MDE, it's not just the governor, it's not just a legislative moment. It's about local control and what we can all do together to attack absenteeism.
Lead Krisha, follow up.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for that. And I appreciate that answer. I think you're right. I think it is a larger conversation. We've had a number of bills, and there's a number of groups around the Capitol that think they have the answer to that. And so I think what I'm hearing from you is we need to figure out what that is, and I would appreciate a little bit more of the governor pushing on that. I don't think that's in this bill. The second piece on this is we had talked a little bit about this, and we had a number of school districts at one point. Chair Joachim had allowed them to testify and talking about some of the liabilities, the mandates that are out there, the UI. And you and I had talked about this looking forward. I don't see anything in here where the governor is helping alleviate some of that, the concerns that schools have had. And when I look at the UI piece looking down the road, that will become a liability. That will become something we have to deal with. Nothing in here from the governor on that. And not that he's silent, but I just, you know, what would be your response? How do we start taking steps to there to give schools the assurance that all the things we're asking them to do will receive support and funding?
Commissioner Jett.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha. And so I'm speaking as the commissioner, but I'm also speaking as a former superintendent.
And Madam Chair, that's why I've asked you.
And I'm looking out in the audience, and I have a few ed orgs out there, that this is one of the conversations or questions that is prevalent, whether you're sitting at a conference, whether we're out across the state visiting sites. And what I can assure you of is and I'm going to use that word historic, with all the different things that happened in this last legislative session, there is, I'm going to use that word, pressure, to make sure that we do things the correct way. And there's so many different things that we're having to make sure we wrap our hands around. You mentioned UI, and that is a topic that is of note all across the state. One of the biggest things is the conversation that we're having with superintendents and business managers and things of that nature is just to make sure that we put that at the forefront and figure it out, and we're studying it. And so it's not something that is just that you can define it immediately. It's that study. You're trying to look at it to make sure that when we do this one, it's kind of similar to my last answer, when we do this one, that we're making sure that we're doing it correctly. And so it's not It's being discussed now, but it hasn't been completely solved now. We're still talking about that.
Follow-up lead, Krisha.
Thank you. And Commissioner Jetta, and I appreciate this is why I like the conversations with you, because there's no value, there's no judging. It is what it is. And as you said, these are pressures we're going to have to address. And so I guess, you know, and what you're saying and what I'm hearing from your former superintendent role as well as the commissioners, we do have to put this in the forefront, and we need to know that these are things that schools are going to be facing. And it just is. And that's, you know, just I want to make sure we talk about it in that context. So thank you for that. My last question for you, and I want to understand this. On lines 15.11, 16.1, 17.19, we add tribal contract schools in as the grantees. Why do we specifically have to add them in? Were they not eligible before?
Commissioner Jett.
Madam Chair and Representative Krisha, and so I do not have my glasses,
okay.
And so I apologize for that. And I could tell you this other story that's going on, but I'm not going to share that with you. Your question was, why are we identifying that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just clarifying.
I have my answer because
okay.
Adosh Uni is sitting right there and he's waving
and he
vigorously. Yep. And so I will go ahead and I will ask Adosh Uni to come ahead and answer that question.
I mean, if there's secret hand signals we don't know about.
Welcome back. Welcome back, Mr. Uni. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, again for the record, Adosh Uni, Director of Government Relations, the Minnesota Department of Education. So, Representative Krisha, the question of why we're adding tribal contract schools to a couple grant programs, and it's because we've noticed along a range of programs, and I think in other programs in the past few years, we've had attempts, successful, some not, to add tribal contract schools because they are not considered traditional school districts. They're not considered traditional charter schools. They are their own separate entities. They're not co-ops or intermediates. And so specifically calling them out as eligible entities make sure that we are recognizing, recognizing their unique nature as well as making them eligible recipients at the same time.
Lead Krisha.
Okay, and Madam Chair, so because they are what we would consider non-public schools.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, I just would like to be clear for the record, I did not state that they're non-public schools. I said they're not considered traditional school districts or charter schools. They are considered tribal contract schools, which are a separate entity. There's not a statute like with charter schools that says that they're eligible as if they were traditional school districts that there is. I think I can't remember what the statute number is. So we do have to explicitly name tribal contract schools. They do because they have a federal, there's a very much a, because they're under the Bureau of Indian Education, under the Department of Interior, they are considered a separate entity as they relate to the federal government, but they are public schools.
Chair Yukim, did you have a comment?
Yes, Chair Flaherty, the one thing I would add too is we had this discussion too when we brought up the money to tribal schools from the land trust is mm-hmm. that we had to backfill it with aid instead because in our constitution the land trust says school districts and tribal schools aren't defined as school districts.
Mm-hmm. Chair Krisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Yukim. So you said this is a broad conversation we've had for many, many years. Mr. Uni, you said tribal schools would fall, you used the word public schools in that. So we have school districts, charter schools, and now are you including tribal schools in that sphere of public?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, committee members, they are a entity that is separate from traditional school districts, mm-hmm. charter schools, intermediates, co-ops, which are all public entities. They themselves are also a public school. They just are run under the federal government. They also receive aid from the state for specifically for tribal contract school aid, do operate serving our schools in the public education system run under the federal government.
Yep.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. And then, yes, so thank you for that. And then I just have a question for Mr.
Chair Kreisha. I'm sorry, Lee Kreisha.
Ron's fine. thank you. I don't, no further. For thank you, Commissioner Jett, and thank you, Mr. Uni. And I just, one simple question for Ms. Schneider.
As you approach the bench, please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, it's the world's least interesting game of musical chairs. I am Caitlin Snyder with Education Minnesota.
Chair, I'm sorry, Lee Kreisha.
And thank you, Ms. Schneider. For so it has been, I've heard oftentimes of taking money away from the public schools, and that when I go back to these sections, it seems like we are, in fact, taking the money out of that the traditional charter schools public realm, and what we would call, and I won't, just for clarity in a non-public role, would Ed Minnesota support continuation of moving those dollars out of that sphere into other non-traditional entity schools?
Ms. Schneider?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Kreisha, just to confirm my understanding of your question, are you talking about the portions of the governor's budget that allows tribal contract schools to compete for grants?
Lead Kreisha?
So my question is a broader sense. So this is, we're starting down a path. If we're going to include tribal schools in the non-traditional, if that's the terminology we're using now, would Ed Minnesota support the continuation of moving those dollars on the grant and other programs? It looks like this is, we're heading down a path where we would open up the door for non-traditional schools to be able to get funded.
Ms. Schneider.
Madam Chair and Lead Kreisha, I feel like Mr. Uni had a much better explanation of how tribal contract schools fit into the landscape of education in Minnesota. These are schools that are held to the federal accountability system, just like our traditional public schools. They are required to administer the MCAs. They are required to serve students that come to them. Education Minnesota has never taken a position against allowing tribal contract schools to be eligible for state funding, and I hesitate to say this, but I would be willing to bet we never will.
Lead Kreisha, follow up.
Okay, and thank you for that, Ms. Schneider. So, I mean, I'm looking at this. Some of these will fund or help teachers in schools that are non-traditional, as the terms. And so what I'm hearing you say, and, you know, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but Ed Minnesota wouldn't take a position one way or the other on the tribal side, but if it was another non-traditional entity, and we'll just call it out, say a private school, is Ed Minnesota going to take a stance on that?
Ms. Snyder.
Madam Chair and Lead Kreisha, tribal contract schools are subject to federal accountability. They are subject to the Americans with Disabilities Act. They are required to provide special education. They do not get to discriminate about the students that they enroll. Education Minnesota has no position against funding tribal contract schools with state funding.
Madam Chair.
Lisa.
Thank you. Good dodge. Ms. Schneider, what about other non-traditional entities? Would there be an openness to that, or would there be, and this will be my final question. I'm not really trying to pin us, but we are heading down a path here, and I just want to see, because I've heard the other way, would Ed Minnesota be open to that, or is that just, and you don't have to answer as well either, I'm sure we.
Madam Chair and Lee Kreisha, Education Minnesota has a longstanding position against private school vouchers. Madam Chair, if I may, I'm very thankful that Lee Kreisha called me up here for a question. There was one piece of my testimony I skipped over that I think is really important for the committee to hear, so I'm going to do a second bite at the apple. There are some changes to EL, what is considered part of the EL cross-subsidy in this bill, and this is very important because we are funding the cross-subsidy because the legislature made such bold steps last year. We have to define what can be funded with that cross-subsidy aid. I would just recommend that the committee takes a close look at that. We have some questions here. I'm not saying we have any opposition to this language, but it's just a very important step that we're taking here.
Thanks, Ms. Schneider.
I'm sorry, I just want to follow up to that one last statement, if I could.
Final statement.
Thank you. I didn't use the word vouchers, but you did. My point on this is, if we're going to find ways to help teachers, teachers are valuable in non-public schools as well as public schools. And I'm not looking to pin one entity against the other one. I'm just saying we're heading down a path. And I do believe that my position would be there are ways to help those teachers in their development, and we should consider that. And it was not by any way looking for vouchers. It was about professional development. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Huakim, do you have any final words on your bill?
Yes, thank you, Representative Clardy. Just saying, this is what we do. We carry the governor's bill and the lieutenant governor's bill just so we can have conversations like this because it's important. Members, thank you for the questions and discussions. And I renew my motion to lay over House File 5237 for possible inclusion in the education finance bill.
So with that, the chair lays over House File 5237 for possible inclusion in the ed finance bill. And I'll hand the gavel back to Chair Yuki.
Musical chairs today, isn't it? With that, we'll move to our next item on the agenda. Representative Berg has been patiently waiting in the audience. And our next item is House File 5007. Representative Berg, welcome back to the Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
House File 5007 before the committee with the intention to lay it over for possible inclusion in Education Finance Bill. Representative Berg, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. In 2023, most of you may recall, legislation was passed to allow school districts to provide transportation to pupils to attend or from an area learning center program to be eligible for state aid reimbursement. $1 million per year was appropriated. The statute as written, however, applied only to traditional school districts, not our other school districts, such as intermediaries and other cooperative school districts. House File 5007 expands the list of districts eligible to apply for Area Learning Center transportation aid to include intermediates and other cooperative school districts. We know students enrolling in ALC programs often find it challenging to attend the Area Learning Center of their choice because of lack of transportation. Removing barriers for these students provides them with greater opportunity for educational success, better attendance, and more opportunities to graduate. With that, I believe I have a testifier who is remote because she ended up not being able to be here in person.
Thank you, Representative Berg. With that, we have a testifier, Michelle Balland, remotely. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Balland. I'm a principal of an ALC that's part of an intermediate district, and I just want to say thank you for listening and having me here with you today. Just as it was what was said before, one of the biggest things that we struggle with is the barrier of transportation with our ALCs. Oftentimes we speak about choice schools, and for many of these students, the ALC that fits them best or that has programming that best meets their unique needs is not the district that's in or not the school that's in their district, and they do choose to attend intermediate districts. Unfortunately, when transportation is limited or it is with other students that might have been causing some of the concerns and problems that are making them interested in coming to us, that transportation barrier still exists. And the students are paying hundreds of dollars in Ubers. I have a student who currently attends, and due to some circumstances out of their control, they're currently spending about $300 a week in order to attend school. And so we have been working on trying to be as flexible as possible so that we're not taxing the family. And this is a situation where transportation would be very important for this student. And there is an immeasurable amount of these stories that I could share in regards to the importance of this transportation money and the availability of it to our ALCs in the intermediate districts. We currently have about an attendance rate. Our kids hit about 50 to 60%, and I think that's pretty average for ALCs. And when we have talked with our students and talked with our families, transportation undoubtedly comes up as the number one reason why students are not attending regularly. And so as an ALC, we create as many opportunities and programs, things that will benefit these students long term. But unfortunately, unless we can get them through our door on a more regular basis, oftentimes they can't access those opportunities. And so we really hope that this amendment to the bill that passed last year will go through so that we can start requesting some funding for transportation and start reducing those barriers. And I thank you all very much for all of the hard work that you're doing and look forward to answering any questions if there are any. And thank you again.
Thank you so much for being with us today. With that, members will move to the table for questions. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the test buyer online. So if Uber leaves the Twin Cities in 28 days, how will the students get to school?
What? Do you have a crystal ball, test buyer?
That's a great question. We're worried about it significantly. So a lot of times the opportunities, like they throw out options like we'll take the city bus or take Metro Transit, things like that. But what we're not seeing is there's a reason why most of these students aren't taking those opportunities. And so I'm very concerned about when Uber leaves. We are in the Northeast Metro, so I'm hoping that it won't impact too many of my students because we're far enough away from Minneapolis that we don't have many students who are in that vicinity. But if St. Paul follows suit, which oftentimes they do go hand in hand, we would have a significant number of students who are, it is going to impact them significantly. And that is very concerning. So this would be one of our biggest answers to what happens if Uber leaves.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
No follow-up.
Okay, thank you. Any other member questions or comments before I go to Lead Krisha? Seeing none, Lead Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Burke, for bringing the bill. I actually think it's a really good bill, and I wish you luck with it. But I do have a follow-up question that Representative Anderson brought up for the test fire. When we talk about the ride-sharing, this is about funding, and if those rates go up significantly, will there be, we're going to have to address that with the Minneapolis School District and with the ride-share rates going up?
I don't think I'll have the test fire answer this. Representative Berg, do you have any other comments? Otherwise, we'll move on. It's kind of moving out of our bailiwick here. I can also go to nonpartisan staff to talk about how the funding mechanism works.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While I do recognize that the Uber-Lyft connect to this is because this is an option that the students are using, sometimes their only option. Not going to lie, my ALC that my youngest son attended to, there was no bus service. And so a couple of times I did put him in an Uber when I had to go this direction, he had to go that direction. So I understand, representatives, why you're bringing that into, why that's a relevant question. I don't have an answer for that. I'm not sure my testifier does. But I think when we talk about removing barriers for our kiddos to have the chance to graduate, to excel, to succeed, this is just one more piece of that that we are able to give them. There are so many, you know, things that frustrate us that we may not be able to provide. This is not one of those things. And so I think if we do go to nonpartisan staff for sort of an explanation of how this would work.
Mr. Shaw, maybe briefly just talk about how we put the funding stream together and what that looks like for reimbursement model.
Madam Chair, Representatives Berg and Krisha, let me make two comments. The first about that reimbursement stream and then the second about pupil transportation. In terms of the language that was enacted last year, essentially districts and charter schools, if they're providing the transportation themselves to the ALC, are able to submit a reimbursement. And this is similar to the way the reimbursement for the inter-district integration transportation works. So it's essentially modeled after that same approach. The district providing the transportation lists its eligible expenses. Those are approved by the department and then reimbursed for that service in just the same way that the integration inter-district transportation has worked over the last 25 years or so. The second question that I heard had to do with the relationship between the rideshare services and schools. Unlike when a parent provides a service, If a school district provides a transportation service to a student, that's regulated under the transportation provisions for pupil transportation. And that means that these outside of the yellow school buses, basically the kind of transportation that happens in vans and elsewise is called type 3 transportation. That's a type 3 vehicle, and there are requirements that apply to the type 3 transportation. So, for example, for many of the Minneapolis school districts, children who are homeless and bused to their initial schools, as required by federal law, those students take transportation in a vehicle that's been approved as a type 3 vehicle. That involves an annual inspection and some other things. It's not real onerous, but there is the requirement on that. So a school district on its own can't essentially call an Uber for a student. That's providing transportation services, and that needs to actually be done in a way that's compliant with the type 3 pupil transportation statute. I'm sorry for the lengthy part of the response there, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Sharma. If I can remember right, too, we put a pool of money in that we rolled into the base that they can use to draw from?
Madam Chair, in terms of the funding, yes. The $1 million essentially is the capped appropriated amount in statute. If the expenses come in at $2 million for this coming year, then those would be prorated and districts would be reimbursed for 50% of their transportation costs. So, depending on the proration level, will determine how much of that service is reimbursed and how much the district will be paying for.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And Representative Berg, I just want to thank you again for bringing this bill forward last year and seeing a need and trying to figure out a way to solve it. And we're waiting to see how this works out last year and this year with the reimbursement to see if we need to put more money into it next year. But with that, Lucretia, did you have a follow-up at all?
All I just want to, and thank you for the conversation, and thank you for the bill. And allowing us to have the tangential, because whether, and I'm really not trying to make this about the Uber Lyft deal. What I'm trying to talk about is student transportation, and we have to recognize that that is one of the transportation vehicles out there for many of these students. In greater Minnesota, you know, we're dealing with some transportation things, and I'll try not to get too far off topic, but just the amount of capacity of vehicles we can have and getting those. So this is very, very important. Thank you for bringing up, Mr. Strom. Thank you. That was a very illuminating conversation. I think that one all of us should pay attention to carefully is the different transportation modes and changes. It is what it is, and people are using those to move students. So thank you. That's all I had. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Final comments.
Thank you. I really appreciated what our testifier said when she said, unless we can get them through the door to our schools, we can't help them. And we have spent so much time and effort and have been really lucky to be able to do some big things for our students and their families this biennium. And to put it so succinctly, if we can't get them through the doors, then none of the work that we have done so far will make a difference. So it is a simple bill. It's just expanding the list of types of schools that can get this funding. And I appreciate the comments and the forward thinking about the Uber Lyft issue and how that impacts it. So I feel like it was a really good holistic discussion on it, which I appreciated. So thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Berg. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 5007 be laid over for possible inclusion in a education finance bill. And members, our work is done today, so I give you some of your time back. We will be back here tomorrow, regular time, regular room. Thank you. We're adjourned.